This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In, where we break up the hour into a few different topics. Coming up, we'll talk to SideFX reporter Jake Harper about how the Indiana Women's Prison is dealing with the pandemic. Some claim the prison is creating unsafe conditions for the inmates. I'll also talk with the head of Earth Day Indiana about how they plan to protect attendees at their event next weekend. And later, what stress from the pandemic is doing to our mental health. I'll talk to two IU researchers about what they found. But first, I'm glad to be virtually sitting across the desk from Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer for the first time in three long weeks. Lauren Chapman, welcome.
Hey, Matt, how's it going?
Not too bad, but let's take a look at the week's news from throughout the state. First of all, the COVID-19 numbers, we crossed a bit of a threshold, just yesterday?
Actually would have been earlier this week for 2,500. We are at 2,555 people who have died from COVID-19. There are more than 50,000 confirmed cases and more than 550,000 Hoosiers who have been tested. So last week, we were just at the precipice to compare things with 2,488 people who had died, nearly 47,000 confirmed cases and more than 504,000 Hoosiers who had been tested. Something important to note is that the number of deaths, especially the deaths reported, have slowed down significantly, both in the reporting and the actual numbers per day. But the cases in the last 2 weeks or so have seen an uptick. Vandenberg County has had some very public concerns about the number of cases in that county, in Evansville specifically. And today's case numbers are a little bit alarming. We had 748 new Indiana coronavirus cases reported over the course, those cases being reported as positive over the course of the last 3 days. Mm. And that is the most and the first over 700 since May 6th. So even when taking into account the number of tests that we're now able to do, 9% of those tests came back positive, which is the most since May 30th. So
we can't just point to more testing being the result of more positive results. We're actually looking at more positive results relative to the testing.
Yeah. And that's a large reason why the state, you know, kind of hit that sort of kind of press pause on reopening, was because they were getting this preliminary data and they're like, oh, wait, it looks like we're about to see an uptick again. Mm-hmm. And based on the state's numbers, it does look like a small, though significant increase, especially if folks aren't taking proper precautions to avoid the spread. Mm-hmm. The other thing to kind of compound things is that testing has also decreased over the last several weeks because of the heat. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Buck said on Wednesday, many of the state's testing sites, especially those run by OptumServe, are either outdoors or in places without air conditioning like state armories. So if you're trying to run tests, it's not safe for employees with all of the PPE that they have to wear to continue to run tests. So that's also another reason why folks are finding it harder to get tested, although testing is now open to everyone.
And as I understand, sometimes at some of these testing sites, the employees running things are having to wear full Tyvek suits, which are not easy to wear in all of this heat and humidity. Mm-hmm. And so that's understandable. All right, let's go to what happened at Lake Monroe last Saturday. What about the assault?
Yeah. So the FBI is officially investigating the assault on Bloomington resident Vox Booker as a possible hate crime, according to Booker's attorney. Vox Booker is a member of the Monroe County Human Rights Commission. He was assaulted by a group of white men on the 4th of July as he made his way through the woods to Lake Monroe to watch the lunar eclipse. The men pinned Booker against a tree for allegedly passing through private property, he says they threatened to use a noose on him. And if you've had the great misfortune of actually watching that video. It's very clear. You can hear that very easily.
It's hard to watch.
Yeah. Department of Natural Resources officers arrived at the scene after all of this took place, after a group of bystanders came in, intervened, and pulled these men off of him. They have jurisdiction over the area. Officers interviewed both groups, watched the cell phone video, and decided not to make arrests, saying they would follow up with the county prosecutor's office. Now, the Monroe County prosecutor Erica Oliphant said the investigation is not taking an unusually long amount of time thus far, and that the office has to receive a full investigation from law enforcement before it can bring charges. But there have been a lot of criticisms over the fact that it has been a week. It seems like an overwhelming amount of evidence from people who are on the outside of that process. And frankly, a lot of people are really disappointed.
And there were protests that erupted as a result.
Yeah. Several hundred folks came out on Monday and Tuesday in Bloomington to protest in front of the Monroe County Prosecutor's Office, calling for the arrests of these men. And during a protest on Monday, a white woman drove into protesters with her vehicle as they were dispersing late Monday. Eventually, she was arrested in Scottsburg. Her name's Christy Bennett. And she was staying in a hotel in Scottsburg, but it took a couple of days of trying to hunt her down and figure out why she drove into protesters. And the video of that incident is also jarring, to say the least.
Well, we'll continue to follow this story for sure. There is a lot more coming on this, I am sure. Let's look at the 2018 abortion law that Indiana tried to put into effect. What did a federal judge say this week?
Federal judge said not today. Permanently struck down the 2018 anti-abortion law that required doctors to report a long list of so-called abortion complications. The 2018 law requires any physician to report complications arising from abortions with a list of 25 conditions, including psychological complications like anxiety. It also imposes a criminal penalty for failing to do so. So the law was already temporarily halted before it took effect. And Judge Richard Young now permanently has struck it down. He said the law is too vague to enforce because it doesn't guide doctors as to how to determine whether the listed complications were actually caused by the abortion or to what degree abortion was a factor. And he said the law could result in overreporting complications to make abortion appear less safe than it really is. All of that being said, there is a second provision in that law that he did okay that requires abortion clinics to be inspected yearly.
Okay. And the Archdiocese of Indianapolis is, I wouldn't say under fire over its transgender student policy. What does it look like here?
Yeah, LGBTQ groups and Democrats at the State House are pushing back against the school policy from the Archdiocese of Indianapolis. The policy bars transgender students from attending schools the Archdiocese oversees, which is 71 schools across 39 Indiana counties. In a letter the Archdiocese put out, they acknowledged the existence of intersex students as an exception to the policy. But it also states, quote, school officials, teachers and students are to interact with students according to their biological sex at birth. To do otherwise would in fact be uncharitable, as it would be confirming such persons in their mistaken understanding of their identity. There's a protest this weekend against the Archdiocese policy that I'll actually be covering on Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so we'll look forward to hearing about that protest next week. And so now we'll look at these lawsuits that advocacy groups say voters should be able to put forth to the state regarding what now? Polling hours?
Yeah. It's a really kind of funky state law that I didn't actually know very much about. that I, which means I love it now. Like I'm so excited to know about it. So voters are able to ask a court to extend polling hours on election day when there are problems voting. Now, just this year, there have been several cases across the country in 2020 in Georgia and Kentucky where courts extended polling hours based on citizen lawsuits. And so the 2019 law, which was kind of buried in another voting issues law that was 130 pages, says only county election boards by unanimous vote can go to court to request extended polling hours on election day.
Not individual voters. It has to be the election boards.
And it has to be a unanimous vote in order to do so. And so especially with all of the, you know, the things that we heard from Marion County with the long lines, I was not able to vote on primary election day because of the long lines. It was a 2-hour wait and I had deadlines. So that's what this lawsuit is specifically pointing to as a real concern.
OK. And there's something going on in Georgia and Kentucky. You already mentioned that. OK,
yeah.
Let's move on to the PPE marketplace. So Indiana had set up this marketplace for small businesses to buy PPE. So this is kind of confusing. Was it through the state or was it through private industry? Anyway, they're throwing it away. What are they doing instead?
So the Indiana Economic Development Corporation put together more than 30,000 orders for personal protective equipment at no cost to businesses of certain sizes. So it was specifically targeted at small businesses that would have more difficulty getting a hold of masks, of hand sanitizer, of gloves, et cetera. And so they're shutting that down. And replacing it instead with a directory to connect Hoosiers with Indiana companies that sell safety gear. The chief of staff for the IEDC, Luke Basso, said that, you know, this directory is designed to be more of a long-term solution for businesses. Previously, the state was the one that was putting together these packages and then sending it out to folks. And this is just kind of cutting out that middleman and just connecting people to resources that they already need.
Okay. And as always, we want to give a shout out to the Indiana 2022 Way. If you'd like to join and help us out with topics, you can text elections to 73224. Again, text elections to 73224. We're covering the pandemic, but we're also going to focus on the election, of course, and find out the issues you care about. Okay. She holds our digital world together with style and grace. She's Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, the Indiana Women's Prison has protocols in place to protect inmates from COVID-19, but some say they're creating unsafe living conditions. Jake Harper from Side Effects Public Media stops by next to talk about his reporting. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with that in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. It's our Friday pitch-in, where we break up the hour into a few different topics. And right now, we want to feature some work being done down the hall at Side Effects Public Media. Although you're not really down the hall literally anymore, because we're all working from home. Jake Harper is a reporter for Side Effects. He's also the co-host of their very popular podcast called Sick, which just won the award for best podcast from the Public Media Journalists Association. But that's not why we're talking today. I just wanted to bring it up. Jake, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're here because you've been doing some reporting on how Indiana's prison system has been dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. And your most recent piece goes into the measures being taken at the Indiana Women's Prison. So I guess before we can understand some of the problems that these measures are causing, we need to understand the layout of the prison. You reported on a specific section of the prison. What is this area?
Yeah, so the units where these issues are occurring are called the cottages. I've never been, just to say that. But the layout of these units was described to me as sort of a common room where in the past inmates would usually be able to hang out during the day. And then off of each of the common areas, there are a couple hallways with the cells. And so each of these cottages houses dozens of women. And in each cell, there are 2 to 4 people who are sort of housed in really tight quarters. But what people really need to understand is that these buildings are old and they're not really designed like you might think when you think of a prison. The cells that the women are housed in don't have toilets or running water. The doors lock manually, so there's no switch you can throw in some part of the cottage to let one door open or all of the doors open at once. A correctional officer has to lock and unlock each one individually. And there's no air conditioning, which especially in the summer, becomes problematic.
You say you haven't been there. How then have you been hearing about this?
So I first started reporting on prisons in April. And actually, I think maybe the first day that I did that, I got a call from a woman inside the prison actually describing the conditions that they were in. And those conditions have mostly persisted since then. I think time has gone on. More people have become concerned about how those conditions are affecting the women in there. And so I spoke with former inmates, advocates, and even an employee spoke to me anonymously about what's been going on there, about these problems.
So what are the protocols that are in place? What are they doing to protect inmates from COVID?
Yeah, so what I've been told, so before the pandemic, women seem to have a lot of freedom to move around. The doors to their cells were unlocked and all the way open. And they could spend time out of their cells. When the pandemic started, the prison basically said, and this is what the Department of Correction told us, we're going to lock you in your cells for most of the day. And there are various stages to lockdown, but it seems like being stuck in their cells is basically the new norm that will persist for a while. To be clear, I think inmates even recognize that these measures do help contain the virus. But the people I spoke to for this story, including the employee, said that because of how these cottages are set up, this is torture. This is punishment. And that's why they were concerned enough and why it became a story.
Gosh, I can think of several problems that might arise, but can you list some of them off from your reporting?
Yeah, so I think one of the major concerns is fire safety. With all of these doors locked, with one correctional officer essentially responsible for multiple cells, I think a lot of people are worried that if there were a fire, there's no way a CO would be able to unlock all of the doors in time to get the women out. And it also causes problems that are sort of more health related. The lack of toilets and running water in these cells have really been complaints since I began reporting on prisons in general and the women's prison back in April. One correctional officer, again, is responsible for dozens of inmates. And since they have to unlock the doors manually, and some of the doors get stuck, some inmates have said that, they've had to wait a long time to use the bathroom. They've said that some have had to resort to using trash cans or cups sometimes to use the bathroom, which is humiliating. And so over time, a lot of inmates have reduced their water intake in order to not need the bathroom as much, which is obviously not healthy and can exacerbate some medical problems. And then some have even stopped taking certain medications that cause your body to produce more urine, which has obvious health effects too.
And you said that there's no air conditioning. I imagine the summer heat is making things worse as well.
Yeah, and I think that's why this issue was being raised repeatedly in the time that it was. The heat basically compounds those problems. These are concrete buildings that get really hot in the summer, even hotter than outside, from what I was told. And it's even worse in the cells because there's no ventilation. They have a small window that's in some of them open slightly, but some of them don't even open at all. So as it heats up outside, you've got these cooped up, dehydrated women inside, and there's a lot of concern about how that could cause things like heat stroke or just exacerbate medical problems that people already have. And I should also say that people have died before in prisons and in an Indiana prison because of heat and a lack of air conditioning.
Well, then, I guess, how healthy is the prison populace there?
So I don't have any specific insight into the population that's in the women's prison right now. We do know that, generally speaking, prisoners are much more likely to have chronic conditions like diabetes, high blood pressure, kidney problems, asthma. They're also much more likely to have mental health conditions like addiction. And I think that sort of feeds into this concern. Being pinned in the heat with so little opportunity to move around has the potential to make a lot of these issues worse. And I have spoken with some people whose loved ones are in the prison who do have diabetes, and you know, the lack of exercise is definitely an issue.
How many women are in the cottages, I guess? How many are in that area?
So what I've been told is that there are 7 units known as the cottages. Most of those don't have air conditioning and are being subject to this sort of lockdown. There is another part of the prison, I think it's called Building 8, that I was told does have air conditioning and better conditions generally. You know, this is also the building where they house solitary confinement. So some of the inmates and former inmates even said they would rather be put into solitary confinement than stay in the cottages because that part of the prison has AC and easier access to a toilet.
Well, and how do you get put in solitary confinement? You get in trouble. I mean, have you heard that some are considering getting in trouble to be put in that better building?
I mean, I think that's what they're implying. I believe one woman did tell me she had done that in the past. This is a former inmate who said she intentionally got herself put into SEG during the summer because of how hot it was. And this was before the lockdown. Another woman wrote more recently that she would rather be in SEG. I'm not sure if she was implying that she would have do something to end up there, but that's something that came up.
How would you say this situation compares to what's happening in other prisons that you've reported on?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Indiana Department of Correction has basically said that the Indiana Women's Prison is a maximum security facility. So we're going to treat it like one. And this is the policy for other prisons, locking people in their cells. And in fairness to the Department of Correction, they responded to our story and said, you know, in this stage of COVID lockdown that the women's prison was in last week, inmates are allowed out of their cells for certain activities, and they do have access to running water and toilets. What they didn't say was how much time women were allowed out of their cells, and the department really didn't dispute any of the issues that we presented to them. Hmm. So I think for the people that I talked to, again, this includes an employee, they said the women are stuck in their cells for about 18 hours a day. I think the reason people are concerned is because of what I just talked about. These cottages are not the same as other maximum security facilities. And the women in them are pretty well behaved, which is why they had so much freedom before. So basically they're saying this part of the prison shouldn't be considered maximum security, and actually treating them like this seems punitive.
Do you plan to continue reporting on prisons?
Yeah, I should have another story out later this week that deals with Indiana prisons. And yeah, I'm still going to keep going.
Jake Harper is a reporter for Side Effects Public Media. He's also the co-host of the podcast Sick. Jake, thanks for your reporting.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The pandemic has made some of us in the free world feel trapped in a lot of ways. More events have been canceled rather than postponed. And many of us are just resigned to the fact that public events just aren't a thing we can really do this year. But not all events have been canceled. Earth Day Indiana celebrates 30 years this year, and what a year for such a milestone. The annual festival draws a lot of environmentally minded Hoosiers to downtown Indianapolis every year to learn about sustainability, recycling, carbon footprint reduction, among other things. Here to talk with us is the executive director for Earth Day Indiana, Greg Ziesmer. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Matt. How are you this morning?
I'm doing all right. So, as I said, it's the 30th anniversary. Was that part of the reason you decided to keep it on this year?
That was one of the motivating factors, and the fact that we were offered the opportunity to reschedule rather than cancel. I took that as, and at the time that happened, I should interject, at the time that happened, things were so obscure as to exactly how they were unfolding, and we still are on, as I say, very shifting sand as far as the ground underneath us, but it was too early to really tell where this was going, and so I went for it. I was like, okay, this is an important event. This is the 30th anniversary celebration. This is my first year as executive director, and I really want to put this on. And then as things have unfolded into closer to the event, I realized just how dynamic that is and how critical it is that we do this right if we're going to do it. And so it's become very clear to me the importance of not just the event, of the but the standard and the bar that we're setting for these types of events under these circumstances.
And it's happening next weekend, a week from tomorrow. And Indianapolis has a face mask order in effect as of yesterday. How are you going to do this?
Well, we did have the forethought as things were unfolding. About 6 weeks ago, I had the idea that we needed to have at least all of our staff, volunteers, exhibitors, and vendors all needed to be protected to project to our attendees that it was a safe environment for them to come and enjoy. And so I somewhat serendipitously discovered a company down in Beech Grove called State Safety and Compliance. I'm going to give them a plug here because they deserve it. They're a locally owned, family-owned business, and they deal in PPE supplies and equipment for events and organizations and businesses. And I called them and offered them a sponsorship in kind for them to provide us with masks and hand sanitizer products for the event. And they agreed. They were happy. They jumped on the opportunity, and I couldn't be more grateful to Abby and Rob at State Safety. They came on board, donated 1,000 masks, and they're also going to be a presence at the festival. So we're going to take that first 1,000 masks and equip all of our staff and volunteers, exhibitors, and vendors. Everyone's going to have a mask if they don't bring their own, especially under the mayor's new order, which we have to honor and respect. It is the right thing to do, and I'm grateful to Mayor Hogsett for taking that initiative. So we're going to have these available, and then when we have a surplus of what's left over of that 1,000 will be available at the Earth Day information tent, our headquarter tent at the center of the event, and also State Safety and Compliance is going to have a booth there where you can purchase them for a nominal fee of like $1. So if you want to come to the festival, you don't have a mask, or you show up at the festival and forgot your mask, whatever, we're going to be able to accommodate you. The other thing we're going to be doing is, throughout the event, they have donated 48 canisters of hand sanitizer. So I'm going to have volunteers stationed at the entrances and exits of all the tents and facilities throughout the park and throughout the event. And they will be administering hand sanitizer as you enter and leave the tents. This won't be an optional thing. It's going to be highly suggested and requested that you just take a quick spritz of hand sanitizer as you enter another aspect or venue in the festival, and just keep it clean, keep your mask on, and move about socially distancing. We're also going to have singular directional traffic inside the tents, so you'll enter and there'll be a clockwise traffic pattern, if you will, in any of the exhibitors' tents, so people can move safely and not be crossing back over each other's paths. We can just be mindful. That's the most important thing. I can't police people's consciousness, but I can highly try and suggest the right thing to do. And by, you know, exhibiting, by creating a positive example, hopefully people will follow suit and we'll all have a great time and be safe.
Have you had any exhibitors drop out? How many are coming?
Well, about half. Yeah, about half have said, you know, and it's been for a variety of reasons. It's not just been COVID, but because of COVID, we had to reschedule, and everyone's schedules are concentrated down into a very short timeline. The track has been very shortened for this season of events, and so a lot of our exhibitors are participating in other events as well, and they were pre-scheduled for this same weekend, so some of them have, you know, prior commitments that they're unable to be a part of. You can't be in two places at one time. And then others have senior members on their staff and their volunteers and their coordinators that just are practicing safe distancing and quarantining themselves and just have said, not this year, but we're in for next year. Let's hope for a better 2021. And then there are others that have stepped up new this year. Earth Charter Indiana, Jim Poyser and his program for resiliency in our community through our young people and our school programming. Jim has come on for the first time this year. And so there are people that see this as an opportunity and take the safety protocol very seriously and are really excited to actively participate under these new guidelines. So this is good because it's resetting the new normal. Like, as I said, we're setting a standard for every other festival that happens after this. We're the first ones.
Half of the exhibitors are coming. What about attendance? Are you concerned about attendance? What if you put this on and less than half of your normal attendance shows up? Are you okay with that?
I am absolutely okay with that. One of the reasons is we are not a ticketed event. We don't rely on gate sales to make this event successful. We rely, as a nonprofit, on sponsorship and on contributions and things of that nature to support us as a nonprofit organization. So we don't rely on selling tickets or gate sales to be a successful organization. I want people to come out, and I think that we will have a good crowd because of the fact that we've been quarantining, we've been being very careful. This is an outdoor event, lots of open space. All of the tents are going to be open-sided for plenty of airflow. We've implemented an 11-point safety protocol and put all of the things in place that we think are everything that we can possibly do that's necessary to make it safe and, you know, enjoyable for people. So I think, and I'm optimistic, that we will have a good crowd. Yeah, it may not be 10,000 people, but it could be five, and I'm fully preparing for that.
Greg Ziesmer is executive director for Earth Day Indiana, which is still on in 2020. One of the few events that is. It'll be next Saturday, July 18th at White River State Park in downtown Indianapolis. Greg, best of luck.
Thank you, man. We greatly appreciate your support.
Up next, new research out of IU shows stress from the pandemic has been bad for our personal relationships. We'll talk with the researchers about what they found. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The pandemic has been hard on everyone for a lot of reasons. Suffice to say, our collective mental health has certainly been better. Two researchers from Indiana University wanted to look at the pandemic's impact on mental health and personal relationships, and they join us now. Zoe Peterson is an associate professor in the School of Education's Counseling and Education Psychology Department. She's also director of the Kinsey Institute's Sexual Assault Research Initiative. Dr. Peterson, welcome.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Ellen Vaughn is also an associate professor in the Department of Counseling and Educational Psychology at Indiana University. Dr. Vaughn, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Zoe Peterson, so you surveyed about 200 people nationwide for this study. What did you want to find out?
Yes, so I was interested in a variety of things. My primary research area is in interpersonal violence. And so I was particularly interested in some of the news reports that I was reading that, at least in some places, reports of domestic and intimate partner violence were increasing. And so reports to police, reports to domestic violence shelters. And so I wanted to look at that, but I also just wanted to see in general how people were psychologically coping with the pandemic and with the social distancing that goes along with that.
What did you expect to find?
Well, I expected to find that there was some psychological distress within the general population. And I think there's no question that the pandemic is stressful. But I didn't know exactly to what extent we would find that. And I thought, you know, based on the anecdotal evidence, that we might find some increases in intimate partner aggression and violence. But again, it was hard to know. There was so much anecdotal reports, but we didn't know things like, you know, are these totally new cases of intimate partner violence, or are these, you know, relationships where there was already violence? So there were just a lot of unanswered questions.
What was it about what's happening, what we're all dealing with, the COVID-19 pandemic? What was it about that that made you think that there might be an increase in intimate partner violence?
Yeah, there was a variety of reasons to think that. So in the past, we know when there's, for example, a big natural disaster like an earthquake or a hurricane or flood, we often see increases in intimate partner violence. Largely, we think because people are sort of, you know, stuck at home together and they don't have other outlets for social contact. And so, you know, anger tends to grow within those, you know, really close relationships where there's no sort of no way to get other social support. And then also in relationships where there's already domestic violence, there's not the same social support to help people cope with that. So their kind of coping resources get sort of overwhelmed. So we thought the same thing could be happening with COVID, especially with social distancing.
So Ellen Vaughn, what were some of the things that you found out from this sample?
Well, so my area of interest is in substance use disorders, and I was very appreciative that Zoe invited me. And similar to the intimate partner violence, there was sort of this anecdotal evidence around changes in alcohol use. And indeed, that's part of what we found, is that about 30% of the sample reported an increase in alcohol use. And this is sort of just one indicator of coping. So people use alcohol to cope often, and we're seeing an increase in that. And it's not always the most healthy way to cope. And it's also something that co-occurs with other things like intimate partner violence and stress.
Ellen, I mean, let's go into more on alcohol use. I know that that factors in, of course. Do you correlate alcohol use with mental health symptoms? Or did you just want to find out if there was simply more drinking going on?
In many senses, I wanted to simply find out if there was more drinking. However, we did find in our study that it is correlated with increases in other mental health symptomatology. That is something that you find in many studies. So these things often go together, and it certainly did in this sample as well.
Zoe, there was more depression and anxiety reported by your sample, but those, I guess, are common enough even in the absence of a pandemic. Did you ask if any of your sample had experienced those kinds of symptoms before?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yes, we did find, we found high rates of depressive symptoms, anxiety symptoms. And I can say we found higher rates than other researchers have found in general community samples when they were doing research in a non-COVID context. So it does suggest that COVID was leading to an increase in depressive and anxiety symptoms. But we did not ask, actually. So we were collecting these data right in the midst of social distancing orders. So in late April, early May. And we asked about how people were feeling right then, but we didn't ask, how did you feel prior to the pandemic? And in part, we didn't do that because we know people aren't very good at remembering how they felt in the past. So we ask these very specific questions about, depression symptoms like, are you feeling down and sad and blue? Are you finding it hard to experience enjoyment in your life? And people are okay at answering those, for how they feel right now, but they have a hard time remembering how they felt before. And especially for negative emotions, if people are currently feeling sad and depressed, that really colors their past memories. So if they're in the midst of the COVID pandemic, they may be thinking, I feel awful now. I'm pretty sure I must have felt that way, a month ago or 2 months ago. So for that reason, we did not ask, but we do hope to follow up with some of these participants longer term to see how these depression and anxiety symptoms do or don't change as social distancing orders are lifted and people are, able to get more social support.
Is it fair for me to ask, I know that you were just surveying a sample and so you were just asking the question, but is it fair for me to ask, I guess, what parts of the pandemic are giving people more anxiety and causing depression? Do we know that, or do you even want to speculate?
Yeah, I don't think we know for sure. And I don't think that our research results can definitively tell us that. I mean, I think that I could speculate, and probably lots of us could speculate as we all are living through it. But I think, stress of worrying about the virus and worrying about illness and worrying about the health of loved ones, the stress of social distancing and not getting the kind of social support that we would typically rely on, the stress of working from home while also in many cases, parenting full time and homeschooling children. I think all of those things probably contribute, but I think we need more research to know kind of what are the most salient factors.
We're talking with Associate Professor of the IU School of Education's Counseling and Education Psychology Department, Zoe Peterson. Also, Ellen Vaughn, who is also an Associate Professor in the Department of Counseling and Educational Psychology there at IU. Ellen, lots of people who drink have been drinking more during the pandemic. Alcohol sales numbers show that pretty clearly. I guess, why could this be problematic? And do we consider this to be problematic across the board or just when it comes to exacerbation of mental health symptoms?
Well, I think this is a great question without necessarily a clear answer. But one of the things that concerns me is that you see an increase in use. And if people aren't engaging in other kinds of coping, so if they're really only drinking and that's their only way of coping, and they're continuing to feel stress with an ongoing pandemic and an ongoing uncertainty about when it ends, that for me is concerning. And I hope that we'll have more research that kind of tells us what is that's going to look like in the long run. But certainly, as people increase their use, it puts them at greater risk for development of alcohol use disorder. And that's also concerning if it's happening alongside with increased stress, increased depressive symptoms, or symptoms of trauma. So those things, we want kind of a long-term snapshot of what that would look like. But when we're looking at a sample where we're seeing 30% of our samples saying that they've increased their use during this COVID-19. As this continues to go on and we continue to have kind of restrictions in our day-to-day lives, I definitely think that's concerning that we might see at least a subset of folks who are starting to have other problems associated with their alcohol use.
And Ellen, part of what you found among your sample were people showing signs of PTSD. What are those symptoms?
So those might be symptoms of kind of hypervigilance, kind of ruminating on particular worries, things like that.
We actually measured not quite PTSD symptoms, but something closely related, which is called peritraumatic symptoms. Mm. In general, we think of post-traumatic stress disorder occurring after a trauma has happened, so usually with, you know, kind of about a month or so beyond the trauma. But peritraumatic symptoms are kind of reactions that people have at the time of the trauma or immediately after the trauma. And those can be things like feeling really helpless, feeling really grief-stricken, feeling really fearful for their safety and the safety of other people. So those are the kind of things we measured and found high rates of those kind of symptoms, which are then predictive of PTSD after that trauma has stopped. And so kind of can result in longer term consequences.
This is interesting. I mean, I think some people, and I would put myself on that list, associate trauma as being a single event, something that happens in a moment or a series of similar moments, and not something like this that's just a drastic societal change that then carries on for months. How broadly can we define trauma?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting question. I mean, I think we often do think, I think, you know, just sort of in when we think of kind of prototypical examples of trauma, we might think of, you know, car accidents or natural disasters or even maybe sexual assaults. But there's a lot of kinds of trauma that are much more chronic. So domestic violence, both intimate partner violence and child abuse is often a sort of chronic trauma. You know, combat can for some people be a chronic trauma. So in that way, you know, COVID being this kind of long-term, more chronic trauma doesn't make it entirely different from other traumas. It is a little different, though, I think, in that it is literally a worldwide trauma. It's something, you know, we often see large-scale trauma in relation to natural disasters, but this is even bigger than that.
Zoe, another thing your study looked at was psychological aggression. What are some examples of that?
Yes. So we looked at aggression within relationships, a variety of different types of aggression, but the most common is psychological aggression. And those are things like name calling, insults, yelling, threats, those kinds of behaviors.
And did the respondents report whether there was any of that going on in their relationships before the pandemic?
Yes, we did ask that. So we found that a large number of people reported psychological aggression in their relationship during the pandemic. Really about half of the people who were in relationships reported that. But those that reported it also reported that they had experienced that in their relationship prior to the pandemic. So it does suggest to us that although it seemed like rates were fairly high during the pandemic, it probably wasn't totally new aggression that hadn't occurred before. These were probably relationships where there was some tendency to do that. And perhaps when they were stressed in the, in social distancing and due to COVID, that they kind of fell back on some of those patterns.
And Zoe, you're the director of the Kinsey Institute Sexual Assault Research Initiative. What did you find on that front with regard to sexual assault and whether or not it increased during the pandemic?
Yes. So again, we found within relationships, there was some sexual aggression, sexual coercion, and sexual assault, as we would expect. But again, in the places where we saw that, it was usually relationships where that had happened previous to COVID as well. One of the things that I'm really interested in kind of looking at long term is I would predict that COVID and social distancing orders would have an impact both on intimate partner sexual aggression, but also on kind of acquaintance rapes as well, but in opposite directions. So, we often hear about college sexual assault, for example, which is perpetrated very frequently by, acquaintances or friends or classmates. That type of sexual assault may actually be decreasing due to social distancing orders because, people just aren't socializing and out together. But I might predict that within intimate partner relationships, sexual aggression may be increasing just because people are kind of stuck together at home.
Ellen, almost every study generates more questions. What more do you want to know?
So this study has generated many questions, and some of the questions that I'm having that come not just from this study, but also kind of the work we do with our students, supervising our students doing clinical work is, how is COVID impacting folks' ability to get care, right? So when we think about things like domestic violence and intimate partner violence and alcohol use and other drug use, access to care is really important. And so was COVID a barrier to getting care for some folks because they were afraid to go out and access care? Were there ways in which many service providers transitioned into telehealth that actually opened up care for folks? So I think those are important questions that when we follow up with some of these participants is to ask them, did they seek care and why they may or may not have sought care. So I think those are some of the things that are on my mind because there's been a huge transition in around how people seek health care and in the case of this study, mental health care.
Zoe, do you plan to follow up with any of your sample?
Yes, so we do. So we collected this initial sample and we ask people in the sample to volunteer to be contacted for future research. And many did. So yes, we will be following up with some of the individuals in this current sample. And we're really interested in changes over time. So how does alcohol use change as people are, returning to work and as their kids are returning to school, and how do mental health symptoms change? So that's one of the things we definitely hope to do.
Zoe Peterson and Ellen Vaughn are associate professors in the School of Education's Counseling and Educational Psychology Department at IU, and they conducted a study on the COVID-19 pandemic's impact on our mental health. Ellen Vaughn, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And thank you, Zoe.
Thanks for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is All In.